The pilot pulled into the clear afternoon air over northern Virginia and turned to the east, toward Tajikistan. Well, I figured, the farther away from Washington, the easier this will be, even in Afghanistan. I was eager to meet with General Franks, our Afghan friends, and our men on the ground. I looked around the tight cabin, filled with bearded, muscular spy warriors with many operational skills and experiences. Some spoke multiple languages, some with native fluency, including a couple of raw rookies, Muslim ops officers. Some were covert action experts. Some had seen combat, some had not. They were dressed in worn jeans or cargo pants. They wore expensive, heavy boots. They had jackets of synthetic fleece with Gore-Tex shells. I realized that I was dressed in similar fashion. We looked like a mob of scruffy, worn 40-something-year-olds miscast for an outfitter's ad. We were quietly discussing the mission, joking a little bit, but not much. One guy was already asleep. The hum of the aircraft, zipping along at 40,000 feet, was relaxing. No phones ringing, no briefings, no politics. The nonstop flight was smooth. I leaned back and slept more than I had in many weeks. Ron, our man in Dushanbe, met us when we landed. Young, competent, and fluent in Russian, he escorted us to his office, a small, rudimentary configuration just big enough to accommodate a few of us. Well guarded and protected by technical barriers, including a shield for all our communications, the office collected intelligence and also served as a key logistics link to Jawbreaker and other teams in northern Afghanistan. The last time I was in Dushanbe, about 18 months earlier, there was no U.S. government presence. Kofor, Ben, Rich, and I had advocated and funded more engagement in the region. Running the war without a toehold in Dushanbe and Tashkent, Uzbekistan, would have been nearly impossible. I spoke with Schroen on the radio and told him that we should relieve him in a couple of days, after the meeting with Franks and Fahim. Schroen provided us an update. The bombing had slowed. It was now sporadic and ineffective, and our Afghan partners were getting impatient with the lack of ordnance on target. The Afghan tribal armies wanted to be cut loose. They wanted to fight, but not without heavy air cover. Dushanbe was unchanged, a huddle of glum, gray, Soviet-style offices and apartment buildings, inhabited by desperate people exploited by corrupt officials and feuding narco-gangsters. We walked several blocks to a cafe where we grabbed some bread and hot sweet tea. The locals stared but said nothing. We retreated to our quarters. The last thing we needed was an altercation with all the political fallout that had nothing to do with our mission. In the intelligence business, so much risk revolves around simple, mundane, quotidian matters in unfamiliar environments. Any risk of being in the wrong place at the wrong time with no operational benefit is dumb. We would stay off the streets of Dushanbe. That night we gathered inside General Franks's C-17 aircraft, sitting on the tarmac at Dushanbe's airport. I shook hands with General Fahim, whom I had never met, and embraced Engineer Aref, the head of intelligence for the United Front. We had worked together for the last 2 years and communicated regularly. I greeted General Franks, Brigadier General Kimmins, the J-2, Admiral Calland, and Colonel Mulholland, and introduced them to Burnson and Hamid, who would translate. Hamid was one of our rookie operations officers. At the table, General Franks held court. We had a map on the table. General Franks pointed to where he could direct air power, explaining that Fahim needed to give him priorities. Where did he want us to strike first? Fahim seemed to want air power concentrated everywhere, which was impossible. This back and forth continued. General Franks explained that we must reinforce success, wherever we were strongest on the ground, wherever we would break through first. Mazar-e-Sharif, Shomali Plains, Talikan. Fahim then said Kabul was the epicenter, but he could not offer a timeline on when his ground forces would be ready to attack southward across the Shomali Plains to Kabul. In a weird, contradictory way, he argued against his own position, because he kept complaining about his ill-equipped troops. He wanted the supplies and money and the air power all at the same time. He wanted as much political as military benefit from this discussion, which was turning into a negotiation. Hamid translated smoothly, confidently. Meanwhile, Bernson and I were growing unhappy, even embarrassed, because our Afghan allies were beginning to dicker and plead. I had told Franks that Fahim and RF would seek some points of leverage, but they had none. I just figured they would relent sooner than this. Fahim now kept stressing the importance of Kabul. Franks, who understood the importance of Mazar-e-Sharif and an eventual overland supply route from Uzbekistan, placed more emphasis on the far north. I interjected that we had to coordinate ground and air strikes and told Fahim that without air power, his forces had little chance of success. On the Shomali Plains, Fahim faced perhaps 50,000 of the enemy. He had less than a quarter of that number in his ranks. Our odds at Mazar and elsewhere were similar. The enemy outnumbered our Afghan allies by very wide margins all across the country. Fahim really had no choice, and finally realized it. General Franks would concentrate on supporting the ground assault on Mazar-e-Sharif, quickly followed by support to Talikan and the Shomali Plains. Fahim understood and acquiesced. Then he took the discussion to a new low, demanding an outrageous sum of cash in monthly payments. An uneasy silence fell over the small group. Franks declared, "Bullshit," and walked away from the table. Fahim wrinkled his brow. He seemed confused. He looked at RF, who understood the expletive. RF frowned, and his eyelids started flapping. He realized what had happened. Bernson snarled something in Dari at them. I stared at Fahim and RF. Everybody was now quiet again. General Franks was outside for a smoke. I also stood and walked away from the table. After an interval of several minutes, we regrouped. I told Fahim and RF that we would provide a monthly stipend, but only for specific needs and supplies, plus extra funds to help recruit Taliban defectors. My figure was far less than they had demanded, but it was sufficient. There was no way for us to account for all the funds once paid, of course, but it was a small price for our allies to save face and for us to move the discussion forward. It was certainly better than spending billions of dollars for U.S. ground forces in strength, offering the enemy more U.S. targets, wasting time in a conventional build-up, and in the long run being less effective. Then we reviewed Allied and enemy positions and discussed a variety of options in our coordinated attacks. We explored details of the special forces deployments. Colonel Mulholland explained how his men would contribute. At the end of the meeting, General Franks promised to meet Fahim in Afghanistan by Christmas. He spoke to them about the bright future of our alliance. After the tense negotiation, our allies needed a boost. General Franks, relying on the personality assessments we had provided and the negotiating strategy we had discussed, was masterful in his performance. There was no better example of intelligence informing a smart customer about essential allies and about covert action merging with a military campaign. I informed Fahim and RF that I would meet them in the Panjshir within 48 hours, weather permitting. Admiral Calland would come with me. Fahim and I agreed to continue our discussions there. The next day, Burnson and I again conferred by satellite radio with Team Alpha south of Mazar-e-Sharif. They were gaining ground. Dostum's forces had captured a Taliban-controlled village. We could hear the last of the fighting in the background of the radio link. Our guys sounded strong and confident, but they wanted more close air support and wanted it now. We also spoke with Schroen, whose 60-year-old gastrointestinal plumbing was in full revolt. Decades of rough eating in rough places had taken its toll. Far worse, he reported that an ill Special Forces soldier from 555 had not improved. He apparently had contracted meningitis. The trooper was in serious condition. Two helicopters had been dispatched to retrieve him. The first chopper had crash-landed in enemy territory, and the accompanying chopper had picked up the stranded crew after they had disabled the damaged bird. An F-16 finished off the useless chopper.